Okay, the very first thing we need to do is we need to establish the setting, that is the context, for the gospel that you just heard. It's the very first ever Easter Sunday. Only the apostles don't realize that it's Easter. The only thing they know is that the man they followed for the last 3 years is dead. They'd hoped that he would be the Messiah. They'd watched him preach to the crowds. They'd watched him mesmerize the masses. They'd watched him work astonishing miracles. They watched him walk on water. They even watched him bring the dead back to life. They hoped and they hoped, right? But that was all over now. Because on Friday he was crucified. Because on Friday he was sealed away in a stone-cold tomb. And the worst thing about it, it wasn't just the grief of what happened. The worst thing about it was that they knew that it was their own fault. Now, of course, Judas was the one who had betrayed him, right? Nobody denied that. But in the Garden of Gethsemane, when the Roman soldiers suddenly showed up, when they arrested Jesus, every apostle did the same thing. They all covered their tails and ran away. And they did nothing to help. They did nothing as Jesus was railroaded through a kangaroo court in the dead of night. When Jesus was condemned to die. When Jesus was scourged to within an inch of his life, his whole body was one great open wound. When they roped a crown of thorns to his head, when they nailed him to a cross and left him to die, they didn't say a single word in his defense. They didn't so much as raise a finger to help him. And this, after so many promises, remember Holy Thursday night? All their promises, they'd follow him until the end. And when they figured out just how quickly that end came, didn't they? Because when things got bad, they all ran away. And why'd they run away? Because they were afraid. They were afraid that what happened to Jesus was going to happen to them too. Okay, that's the setting. Now we're on Easter Sunday night. And suddenly, inexplicably, Jesus himself appears right in front of them. And how he got into the room, nobody knows. The door was locked. And after they rub at their eyes in stunned disbelief, just to make sure they aren't hallucinating, a sudden penitential silence, a hush, descends across the room because every apostle in his heart is thinking the exact same thought. They're thinking, uh-oh, what's he going to say to us now? After what just happened, what is he going to say to us now? And then Jesus speaks. And he says the last word anyone would ever expect Jesus to say. He says to them, peace. In Hebrew, you know, it would have been shalom. He hadn't come for revenge. He hadn't come to extract punishment. He hadn't come to accuse. He hadn't come to condemn. Why did Jesus come for? He came to set right everything that had gone wrong. And that, brothers and sisters, is divine mercy. That is what today's feast day is all about. It was Pope John Paul II who first established this feast day. It was in the year 2000. And that from there on after, the Sunday after Easter would be designated as Divine Mercy Sunday. So you know, it's a brand new feast day. But it's a message, Divine Mercy. It's a message that's as ancient as the faith. So what we want to do today, we want to better understand what Divine Mercy is. And we want to understand what God expects of us as a consequence. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do, we're going to understand what divine mercy is not. Because you don't need me to tell you. Tell me if this isn't true. In the popular imagination, right, rank and file, don't people in their minds imagine that divine mercy means that there's no such thing as sin anymore, right? That you can do whatever you want. God's cool with it. Sin as much as you possibly want. Because after all, when this is all finished, everybody's going to heaven. Shoes and stockings, riding on a toboggan, right? Well, I hope you already know that that's not what divine mercy means. Because when Jesus shows up to his apostles here in his gospel, what does he say to them? Does he say to them, oh, come on, guys, you guys didn't do anything wrong. Come on, guys, I'm not here to lay into you. Come on, guys, you only abandoned me in my hour of desperate need and left me to die, but come on, who hasn't done that among friends, right? No. What does he say? He says, peace. And like I said, what's the Hebrew word for peace? Shalom. Now, some of you already know this, but shalom is a very rich word. When we say peace, it comes from the Latin word pax, and pax just means a truce. It means like, you know, two armies that were fighting, well, now they're not fighting, right? Shalom's a lot deeper than that. Shalom means that everything wrong has been set right. Shalom means health. Shalom means wholeness. Shalom means completeness. And when you've done wrong, that's what you want in your heart. Anybody with a conscience has healthy guilt when they've done wrong and know it. Now, I know guilt gets a bad name, especially Catholic guilt, right? But I'm not talking about some kind of wrong-headed, psychotic guilt. I'm talking about healthy guilt. I'm talking about having a good conscience. You know the difference between right and wrong. And tell me if this isn't true. When you do wrong, you know it, and you want peace. I had a psychology professor once in college. Now, this is a secular school, don't get me wrong, right? Secular school. And he says, you could, if you wanted to, stand on this corner of any busy street in the country and look at every single passerby and point an accusing finger at him and say to him, guilty, guilty, guilty. And every single person say the exact same thing, guilty. And you know what? And he says, you know what people would think? They'd all think in their hearts, how did he know? They might think you're crazy, but they also think, how did he know? We want that peace. We yearn for that peace. We want peace with ourselves. We want peace with God. We want peace with one another. And today's feast day is all about that. If you want that peace, there's two things we need to do. We need to give mercy, and we need to receive mercy. A little word about each. First thing we need to do, we need to receive mercy. And before you can receive mercy, let's have a little deeper understanding of what it is. I took a retreat once. The theme of the retreat was this: mercy belongs to those who do not deserve it. And I did a double take. And you might do a double take too. So say that to yourself again. In fact, say it over and over again until it sinks in. Mercy belongs to those who do not deserve it. Where did I get that idea from? I got it from biblical Hebrew. We said it 7 times in our psalm response, believe it or not. In Hebrew, there are 5 words for mercy. You know, it's amazing. In the English language, you know, no one's quite sure how many words there are. Some people say there's 100,000 words in English. Some people say there's as many as 500,000 words in English. But in biblical Hebrew, there's only about 7,000 words. And out of a language of only 7,000 words, they've got 5 different words for mercy. And you know the word that we kept saying over and over again in our psalm response? It's the Hebrew word hesed. And hesed is a word that means mercy, and this is its essential meaning, that belongs to you when you do not deserve it. You want to know what hesed means? Think about the prodigal son. Remember him? Prodigal son. Did he deserve mercy? No, he deserved a swift kick in the pants. That's what he deserved. Think about the Good Samaritan and how he treated that traveler who got himself into trouble in his own carelessness and recklessness. Did he deserve mercy? No. So the first thing we need to understand about mercy is stop thinking you have to earn it. We might not be merciful one to another, but the message today is God gives mercy to those who do not deserve it. But there's a way in which we have to receive it. We receive it by confessing out loud what we've done to somebody else. The natural way for guilt in our hearts to be expiated is to say out loud, I'm sorry, and say what you did. And then to hear somebody else say back to you, it's okay, you're forgiven. I forgive you. I took a trip once. And on this trip, there was a psychiatrist. And at one point in the trip, he and I, we went off and took a walk, just talking, you know, one to the other. And I turned to the psychiatrist and I said, God, I wish I could know all that you know. And he turned back to me and he said, I wish I could know more about confession, because let me tell you something as a psychiatrist, he said to me. Whenever anybody does anything wrong and they know that it's wrong, there's only two things they ever do about it. Only two things they ever do about it. Number one, they open up and say out loud, I'm sorry, to another person, or they punish themselves for what they've done. Let me tell you, you Catholics with your confession, healthiest thing in the entire world. Every religion ought to have something like confession. And you know, that's part of why Jesus established this sacrament. People say, how do you know Jesus established the sacrament? Well, would you believe it's right here in the gospel that we read? Here's the citation, John chapter 20, verse 23. And he breathed on them and said, whose sins you forgive, they are forgiven them. It's the first time that God has ever breathed on anybody in the Bible since the creation account of the book of Genesis. Something special is going on here. He breathed on Adam and gave him life. And he breathed on his apostles and gave them the power to give away spiritual life. Give it away to anybody who asks for it. And that's why since the dawn of the church, sins committed after baptism have been forgiven by people confessing aloud. And by hearing someone say the words our hearts yearn to hear, I absolve you. Now go in peace. That's how we receive mercy. But we have to do more than just receive it. We have to give it. We have to give it the way Jesus gives it to us. And you know what that means? That means we have to forgive. Now forgiveness is a big subject. We'll have another homily on it some other day. But just understand this. Forgiveness is not a feeling. Forgiveness is not an emotion. Forgiveness is a choice. And the choice goes like this. I choose not to hold this against you. I choose not to hold it against you in which what I choose to think about, in how I choose to speak, and in how I choose to act. Forgiveness is not an emotion. When you forgive, you might still feel hurt. No, in fact, you will. You might have to forgive over and over and over again every day for the rest of your life. You might still feel broken inside. You might not be able to trust the person again. That's not forgiveness. Forgiveness is the choice to say, I do not hold this against you. Because that's what we want God to do to us. So divine mercy, brothers and sisters. Anybody who thinks it's cheap doesn't know what they're talking about. Divine mercy cost Jesus his life. And honestly, divine mercy costs us our lives too, doesn't it? Because it's a kind of death to forgive over and over and over and over again. In fact, I think this is honest truth. One of the reasons why you have so many things throughout the course of the day in which you have to repeatedly turn and forgive is because God's honest truth, there's so many things we need God's forgiveness for. And he's given us practice, right? Thanks be to God, we got things that we can forgive. The idea comes from the Sermon on the Mount. The highest possible authority. Blessed are those who show mercy. Mercy shall be theirs. The idea comes from the Our Father. The highest possible prayer. Forgive us of our trespasses. How much? How much? As we forgive those who trespass against us. Because in all truth, we all yearn for this mercy. We're all just like the apostles. We want peace. We want peace. And so today, let's remember to give mercy and to receive it, that his joy might be in you and your joy might be complete. Amen.